Okay, can I close? Do you have a door?
I sure certainly don't. Will that pick up some of this time?
No, really, well, that's all right. Let's just go ahead and try it.
Okay.
Unless you have another office. Okay, today's April 18th, 1977, and we're talking with Lewis Coleman in the Urban League. And this is part of the series of tapes for Black Oral History that we're conducting at the Oral History Center at the University of Louisville. And I wonder if we could begin, perhaps, by getting some biographical information from you, where you were born and raised, and your education, and eventually how you became involved with the Urban League.
Okay. I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, in an area called the Jackson area in 1943. At 625 Finza Street. My education, early education, was at Booker T. Washington, Jackson Junior High School, and Central High School. Later, I attended Indiana University and graduated from Kentucky State University and received my master's degree at the University of Louisville. After getting out of college, I had a brief stint with the Pittsburgh Pirates baseball organization. And then later, I came on over to the Urban League. In 1969, I began my tenure with the Urban League, and I've been with the Urban League ever since that period of time. The areas of concern that I have addressed myself to at the Urban League is an area of housing and community affairs. And basically, I've been somewhat of an advocate for equal rights and civil rights for disadvantaged people and minority people in this community for the past 7 or 8 years that I've been with the Urban League. Areas of concern such as police and community relations, decent housing for the low income, programs for the elderly. Constantly we have been meeting with committees and boards in this community to better the life of disadvantaged people. Some of the boards and committees that we have met with have been the Civil Service Board, the University of Louisville Board of Trustees, the Housing Authority Board, countless, the Library Board, countless boards we've met with.
Your experience in Louisville has been from about 1969 then here with the Urban League.
Right, that's my, I guess you would say, the human relations experience. Even though I was reared in Louisville, that has been my extent involvement with people in this community from 1969 until the present day.
In that time period, I wonder if you could describe the thrust of the desegregation efforts in Louisville that you dealt with.
We're talking about overall desegregation in the area of
any field.
In the area of housing, desegregation efforts have been very, very slow, almost minute. Blacks still live in several little ethnic enclaves in this community, in the West End part of town, the Newburgh part of town, the California, Jackson, Russell, and Park Duval. Louisville is still a very, very segregated housing arena. At one time, Louisville was complimented on its affirmative marketing plan as far as housing thrust. At this time, Louisville can't be complimented because there is evidence that local realtors are encouraging scare tactics when black families move in predominantly white neighborhoods. When black families integrate neighborhoods, there's an avalanche of local realtors that discourage the white families from staying in those neighborhoods. And the neighborhoods are becoming segregated, more segregated.
Could I interrupt you?
Please.
That was in the newspaper recently. Mm-hmm. Has there been any final results, any court action concerning,
well,
those problems, or any of the realtors named or exposed?
One of the hardest things to do is to get individuals who have been approached by realtors to file a actual and a written and complaint against a realtor or builder who is doing this type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very difficult. The individual who has been approached by the local realtor feels that somehow retaliation is going to come against them if they file such a complaint. We've had the FBI in this community and also local housing officials to try to get people to submit valid complaints and written complaints against realtors who are implementing such action. We have written a letter to the Kentucky State Real Estate Commission here in Louisville, and the letter stated that if any realtor implements scare tactics and is found guilty of this type of violation, which is against Kentucky state statutes, that this realtor should be license should be revoked. That's what we've done as an agency. But other than that, nothing else has happened.
Have you been able to get any licenses revoked?
Not at this date. In fact, we're having difficulty in getting a response from the head of the Kentucky State Real Estate Commission. We've sent him the letters, documented, it's in our files. We've been trying to set up a meeting with him to discuss the issue at length, but we've been unsuccessful. So we're still trying to set up a meeting with the head official.
So you have some cases before him now, but nothing has been resolved.
Nothing has been resolved, right.
Yeah, well, I don't want to infringe on those cases. How about, along these same lines, have you run into the redlining practices of the banks in your...
To be quite honest, we haven't even had the time to get into redlining. Right on my desk, and even though we're talking over the microphone, I have a huge document on redlining in which we are in the process of sending to the governor of the state to ask him to set up a commission in the area of redlining. The Illinois state legislative branch has the governor appointed a commission to deal with redlining throughout that state. And this document that we have, we want to encourage the governor of this state to do the similar thing, because we feel very strongly that redlining exists. As I mentioned, we haven't even had the time to get into redlining. As you talk to other people who work with black agencies, you find out that oftentimes these individuals are all things to all people. They deal with housing, they deal with employment, they deal with education, and that's our case here too. So when we get a chance to deal with redlining, we will. We haven't really gone into detail on it.
In the future.
Right. You were talking about desegregation in all areas.
Yeah.
I just mentioned the housing arena, but we've also had a great amount of difficulty in desegregating our police department. It's in 1921, the first black police officer by the name of William Downs became a part of the Louisville Police Department. Yeah, I may stand correction on that day, I believe it was 1929. The Urban League, during that period in the 20s, was very instrumental in recruiting black officers for the police department, which is a function of a civil service department recruiting black officers. In 1940, Louisville, Kentucky was commended on its hiring of black officers. In one 1940 class, there were about 11 or 12 blacks in that class. Jesse Taylor was one of the officers in that class. Since then, Louisville has retrogressed, and its recruiting efforts have been counterproductive. And right now, Louisville, Kentucky has about 800 white officers on the department, with about 50 blacks in the department. There's a court case, which will be this month, looking at the hiring practice of the City of Louisville Police Department. I will be subpoenaed to testify against the city and its hiring practices next week. I received a deposition, and I have to appear before the lawyer tomorrow in regards to Louisville, Kentucky's hiring practices, and it's been pretty regrettable. The Urban League has referred over 700 black people to the Civil Service Board in order for them to be hired as police officers in, from 1973 until 1977. And approximately 15 or 20 of those persons have been hired. So we do have to deal with this problem through the courts now.
What is the Civil Service Board of the city's main reasons for not hiring these people? Are they flunk their standard tests or?
Well, I've worked with two civil service directors, Jack Richmond and Janetta Preby, the current director. The constant concern that I heard from Jack Richmond that blacks will not want to be a part of the police department, blacks cannot pass the examination. We eliminated that old Chesterton, that old cliche, because we found out that blacks did want to be a part of the police department and that blacks could pass the test. Now it's the, when blacks want to become police officers, when they are passing the test, new standards were set up. And I don't want to sound like I'm complaining, but new standards were set up to eliminate blacks as far as being a part of the police department. And those new standards were set up that you have to post the highest grade score, you have to have the highest physical agility score and so forth. And we just see that there's no affirmative action commitment from top administrators in this city, from police department officials and from civil service officials. And that's why it's in court right now.
Do you, back, one of your previous statements that rang a bell with me, one of my classes at U of L in political science indicated that the policeman does not want to necessarily live in the neighborhood, that he has to patrol for fear of reprisal.
Right.
Do you find that to be the case?
88% of Louisville police officers live in the county. And we find that very regrettable as a community agency that works with disadvantaged people, black and white, in this community. We find it counterproductive for a police officer to know anything about the individuals that they're dealing with in that particular community if they live elsewhere and don't live in that near vicinity of that community. Atlanta, Georgia, Detroit, Michigan, these two cities that I know of are working on that type of concern. Even the mayor in Atlanta, Georgia, was very instrumental in drafting some ordinances to say that police officers in Atlanta, Georgia must live within the inner city, must live in the area in which they're patrolling. We find that if individuals do not know anything about the community that they're patrolling, that oftentimes they can't deal with some of the community problems. And we have a very great void of adequate police and community relations in this community, not only in the black areas, but in the low-income white areas, Portland areas, and the Manly area, and other areas in this city.
Would there be any problem, though, for a policeman, say, that lived in one of those areas you just said, if he arrested someone in his neighborhood that he lived in, that there would be reprisals against himself or his family?
Well,
is that a fear? Or
the black police officers that I know, the retired Major Johnson, Edward Walters, who's a sergeant that lives in the Cecil area, Ralph Shelburne, Virgil White, Jesse Taylor, I can just go on and on and name black police officers that live in the city now that have arrested many, many young people, old adults, and have even been in gun battles. And never have I heard of them talking about reprisals from the citizens that they live with in their immediate neighborhood. And I think it keeps a police honest. If he lives in that neighborhood, he knows he's going to have to do positive and adequate policing. He knows that if he misuses or abuses someone or abuses their rights, that there could possibly be a reprisal in that particular neighborhood. But if police officer is known as an honest police officer that who will not abuse a citizen's right, then I don't think that police officer gets any flack from black people and poor white people in this community. You hear that argument from those individuals who do not want to live in the city. That's the argument that you hear. In fact, if you look at the city officials who run city government, most of them don't live in the city. They live in the county.
Okay. Let me, do you have any further comments concerning desegregation? How about with on the job opportunity and the unions, craft unions especially?
There are various companies that I've worked with, and I can just name them, in which we have been trying to get them to integrate and hire more blacks and desegregate their working facilities. And one is the mass media, the television arena. There are very few blacks in the mass media arena, and that includes the newspaper. We have a sports department, Louisville Courier Journal, which Louisville Times and the Courier Journal, in which there are 45 employees in the sports department, and none of them are black, in an area in which is very heavily populated with black athletes. That's a concern. In fact, that total newspaper is a concern as far as its affirmative action. We've also have worked with, had successful dealings with the water company, in which they have already on record with the Urban League a very positive affirmative action program, but it could be better. They are trying to reach the ratio of 15% of blacks in their company. Whenever we work with companies, we try to encourage companies to have at least 24% blacks in the workforce. One particular company in which you may erase this part of the table is University of Louisville. We've been working with the University of Louisville the past 4 or 5 years in their hiring practices. We are very concerned about the lack of black professionals at the University of Louisville. 87% of the blacks that work at University of Louisville are not in a professional status. Over one-third of the employees are in custodial and janitorial positions at the University of Louisville. Still today, the coaching staff leaves a lot to be desired at the University of Louisville with all the black athletes that it has. Now, you may erase that.
No. I wonder if I could read a quote to you.
Okay.
This is from the book, From Slavery to Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And one passage stated that in 1963, this is in the 1960 areas, there were about as many demonstrations in the North and West as in the South. And the emphasis was on increased job opportunities and an end to de facto segregation in housing and education. The demonstrations sought to block tax-supported constructions on which Negroes receive little or no employment, prevent constructions of schools in all black neighborhoods, obtain legislation to strengthen voting rights, desegregate schools, and desegregate public facilities. Regarding that, this passage, what happened in Louisville here, or at least from the time you became involved, were these similar goals?
These were similar goals. As I mentioned, I became active in Louisville around 1969. I was away at school at the time when these open housing accommodation issues were being dealt with, when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. came to this city, and when the Reverend Leo Lesser Jr. was leading various marches, and when I read in the paper about how many local Louisvillians were being arrested and so forth. I was away at school at the time, but these things did come about. Louisville, Kentucky is a very, very passive city when it comes to individuals dealing with the actual civil rights and God-given rights in this community. And it must have really been some outstanding leadership to get as many people to demonstrate, to come out in the streets and deal with some rights.
Go ahead. Okay, we're back on.
Yeah. During the 60s, it must have taken some outstanding leadership to get as many people to come out and participate in the demonstrations in Louisville. And I guess Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had a great deal to do with that. During the 60s, we had a lot of laws put on the books.
City ordinances?
City ordinances, statewide ordinances put on the books.
Civil rights.
Right. In the civil rights movement. But those ordinances are on the books. But it's a great concern of mine today in the 70s to have those ordinances and statutes actually implemented, because we see very little implementation of those ordinances. That individual, that there should be affirmative action in city and county government. There is no affirmative action in county government as far as its hiring practices. There should be affirmative action in state government. There is no affirmative action in state government. You know, I guess you could classify the employment practices of state and county government as just equal opportunity employment. City government is a little better than state and county. There are blacks in decision-making positions in city government.
What was the major thrust of the Louisville civil rights movement? Increased job opportunities? Housing
and
use of public facilities. Were they all intertwined, or was there one that really stood out?
Well,
is that a fair?
Housing and
school desegregation.
School desegregation wasn't that great of a problem. I was a part of that school desegregation era. When Omar Carmichael was the superintendent of the Louisville school system, school desegregation wasn't that great of a problem, because you had a very positive media which supported school desegregation. You had University of Louisville, which was leading the way at that time. They were doing some very affirmative things out in the community. You had the political officials who were very much for and supported school desegregation, and it went off pretty smooth, because I left Jackson Junior High School and I attended Parkland Junior High School at one time, an all-white school, and things went rather smooth during that process. A little different than today, because those factors that I mentioned that were positives are not positive today behind the school desegregation efforts now. There is the negative media, mass media. There's the negative response from political officials. There is the University of Louisville itself, which is having trouble in having equal opportunity employment. And I think that's basically it. But in answer to your question, I believe the major thrust in the 60s was to obtain housing where one wanted to live, instead of the little ethnic enclaves in the city. At that time, you had Little Africa in the heart of the West End, and it was just deplorable, the housing conditions and so forth, and black people were just so upset, and poor white people. During the 60s, you had just as many whites picketing and boycotting as you did blacks. When I would look in the papers, as I mentioned, I was away at school, and I would look in the papers, I would see the marches, and I would see many, many whites in the marches, just as many.
West End residents.
And it gave a lot of, I think it gave a lot of thrust to the efforts that the individual Louisville were doing during that time.
For housing, how have those efforts been successful, and have they been failures?
Well, the efforts have been successful, and at the West End was certain parts of the West End was very segregated, and blacks could not live where they wanted to live. Now the West End is almost predominantly black. It was successful in that effort that you could live where you wanted to live, but there's always, I don't care what type of laws you get on the book, there are always individuals who can find ways to get around the law and to go back to the segregation type of tactics. There are realtors who know how to get around the law. There are people who are employment officials at various companies who know how to get around the law. Oftentimes when I'll go to a company and talk to them about affirmative action, they'll state to me that the courts have stated that women are a minority and they have to be a part of affirmative action. And oftentimes the black male and black female have suffered because of this way of trying to get around the actual affirmative act of hiring black males and females. and they use women as a minority, and it really phases out a lot of jobs for black males and females. But there are very, very subtle ways in which the laws that are on the book can be dealt with and individuals get around it.
Mm-hmm. Let me move on to a follow-up question of that source.
Okay.
I just dropped my notes here. Again, from that same book, From Slavery to Freedom, one passage stated that during the years of the Negro Revolution in the 60s, it was widely assumed that the vigorous thrust for equality had begun to close the economic gap between Negroes and whites. The assumption was entirely erroneous, caused in part by the opening of a few widely publicized opportunities that can best be described as massive tokenism. Economic differences failed to increase. In 1963, the unemployment rate of Negroes was 114% higher than whites. Is this descriptive of today?
That's very. That's very descriptive of the day. I believe the unemployment rate is 17%. At the latest time I looked at the statistical breakdown of unemployment for blacks in this country, and I've even heard reports that it's even 40% in certain areas, in certain cities. I personally do not ever feel that the economic gap will be equal. Black economic standards will be equal to whites in this country, in this city, in this state, because of the existing attitudes that we have with top administrators who hold the positions and the job thrust for people in various employment arenas. When I look at the engineering field, every company that I'll go to will ask me for black engineers, and they know that it's highly impossible for me to come up with black engineers and in abundance. There are black engineers, but they're not in abundance. That's another subtle way to get around from affirmative action. But as far, and the economic gap is still, it's not getting narrow. It's not narrowing. It's widening, even today. You know, you have the, I look at the University of Louisville. I hate to keep saying the University of Louisville, but I look at the number of blacks that are on tenure at that university. There are about maybe a handful of blacks on tenure, and I mean a handful, four or five, in comparison about 327 individuals that are on tenure. Now, there's a way to deal with that problem, even with blacks on the staff. If you know that the requirement for a person to be on the University of Louisville staff, that you have your PhD, then you set up some type of incentives for that individual, to that minority individual, whether it's black, white, Puerto Rican, doesn't make any difference. You set up some incentives, some financial aid, some scholarship, some type of stipend to encourage that racial group, that ethnic group, to get their diploma, get their qualification so they can get on that staff. That's, and then maybe the economic gap could narrow instead of wide.
What do you see as the best strategy for the segregated businesses? The best strategy for blacks to integrate jobs. Setting quotas. I know quotas, all of a sudden, it's like raving a red flag in front of some of these people.
I believe quotas. I believe we have to go to quotas. I'm always told that quotas aren't the best way and that courts are throwing out quotas. Mm-hmm. But if you leave it up to companies to come up with goals and objectives, don't do it. I really have a concern. I think that if you don't have quotas, you ought to have some timetable. Saying by this particular time, I'm going to hire five women, I'm going to hire five blacks at this particular time of the year.
Actually, a timetable gives the businessman more leeway.
That's right.
Than a
quota, right.
Actual quota.
That's right. In fact, that is what we're asking the police department to do. Mm-hmm. I think the courts may be asking them to do it also, but we were trying to do it before the courts ask them, and we think that it's easier for the individual institution to cooperate with a local agency than the courts. And that's why we're giving the city some timetable, mm-hmm. but they're not listening.
Mm-hmm. So, actually, you're going more away from a quota system, although you would like it, to a timetable system.
Well,
kind of testing that to see if it works out. Or?
When I go to these companies, I deal with quotas, mm-hmm. oftentimes, and when I'm told that quotas are against the law, then with the other alternative, then we talk about timetable, right? Mm-hmm. So I know the quotas, courts have thrown out quotas, but we deal with an alternative, we deal with timetable.
Very interesting. What would you consider to be the most significant event in beginning desegregation in Louisville? Perhaps if you can even stretch back to the segregation laws that once existed in Kentucky, the day.
Classes at Kentucky State University, at Kentucky State College at the time, when the classes could have been given at University of Kentucky. Berea College, as early in the early 1900s, wanted to integrate its schools with black students. But the law, as it stood on the books, prevented Berea College from doing that. The Day Law, the amendment of the Day Law, was probably the most significant event during our time because education, what it means to black people as progressing through the system of our society. I think also in 1921, a gentleman by the name of A.D. Porter ran for mayor in this city. And I think that was a very, very influential move in this city in 1921. Also, Woodford Porter became the first black to be elected to the Louisville Board of Education. And now he's the president of the University of Louisville Board of Trustees. That was a very influential move. Blacks being heads of schools, there was a great wealth of educators in this community. A.E. Mazique and Russell, I can think of, even Dr. Parrish, who is still alive today. The Wilson brothers, who were administrators at the Municipal College, they were outstanding administrators. I think that was a great breakthrough. Samuel Plato, the contractor who built the homes on Northwestern Parkway, that was a very great thrust, because Samuel Plato, during the Depression, was hiring blacks and whites in this community to work in order for them to survive during the Depression era. But that doesn't deal with the most significant accomplishment. I'm dealing with personalities and individuals now.
Okay. You're leading into my next question.
Okay.
I was going to ask you to identify some of the more influential black leaders in Louisville, and you already started on that.
Right.
Perhaps you could back up
okay.
and speak a little bit more about A.E. Mazique.
Okay. Well, A.E. Mazique was the founder of the Urban League. He took a housing survey and found out the housing needs in this community, and he was the founder of the Urban League as it exists today. Also, A.E. Mazique was the founder of the Chestnut Street Branch YMCA. He was the principal of Jackson Junior High School at one time, Central High School, and Booker T. Washington. There's a school named after him today. But in education, I guess we would rank A.E. Mazique as one of the outstanding educators in this community. Along with A.E. Mazique, there was a woman by the name of Maude Brown Porter at Central High School. She was assistant principal, but this woman was known as a disciplinarian from 1916 to 1960. From the 1920 to 1960s. She was a diplomat in that school, Central High School. She was very, very rough on students who didn't toe the line. And students respected her because she taught many of the students' mothers and fathers who came under. I remember in 1959 at Central High School, Maude Brown Porter called me in her tardy room, and it was a detention room. When you acted up in class or if you came to school late, she'd bring you in. And I can remember her exact statement. She said, "Coleman, I had your mother in here, and I had your father in here, and I got you in here, and now you're going to straighten up and fly right." So she was, every student who went to Central from the 20s to the 50s knew Maude Brown Porter. If I've already mentioned Samuel Plato, but in the sports arena, I think of Henry Arthur King. Henry Arthur King was an outstanding coach in this community. He coached at Central High School, later went to Kentucky State College and coached them to an outstanding football team. And then in the 40s, he made $10,000 as a coach at Tennessee State University. He was simply outstanding. I think of Charles Henry. Many people don't know Charles Henry, but Charles Henry pitched for the Zulu Cannibals in Louisville, and Charlie Henry played against great baseball players like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson. He pitched against some of the greatest baseball players that ever lived, Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth, and this man spent most of his lifetime in Louisville. He died several years ago. But
is this an all-black baseball?
Yeah, this was an all-black baseball, right. He wasn't inducted into the All-Black Baseball Hall of Fame, but Charlie Henry was very instrumental in working with young black athletes in Louisville, taking them to the Cincinnati Reds camps and so forth. This is oftentimes forgotten about this great man. One of the first black doctors that we had in this community was Dr. J.A.C. Lattimore. And there was a Lattimore Clinic on Walnut Street, I believe it was 13th and Walnut. But at that time, if you went to Dr. Lattimore's office, it would cost you 50 cents to see the doctor. Those are just a few of the individuals that I can think of that were just very outstanding. I guess individuals that talked to you about Charles Anderson. Charles Anderson was very instrumental in abolishing the lynching laws and setting up integrated nursing schools and so forth. Harry McAlpine, former NAACP official and also an attorney in Louisville. I think of Dr. Parrish's father, who was at one time an official at Simmons University, and that was the Biblical College, an NAACP official. Nathaniel Harper was the first black judge and the first black lawyer in the city of Louisville. Louisville has it goes down in history as having the first boycott in the nation, in the United States. In the 1890s, black men could not sit down on the streetcars, and they had to stand out on the edges of the streetcars. And the black men refused to stand on the edges, and they wanted to sit down. And that was taken to court. Nathaniel Harper, the black judge at that time, the black lawyer at that time, handled that particular case.
That's interesting. Moving on to a different kind of question. Are there any differences in Louisville for blacks when you were growing up and today? And possibly what could they be?
Well, there's a difference in the education arena. When I was growing up in Louisville, we knew that education was the key to whatever success you obtained in life. And today it seems that there's a new breed of youngsters in this community as far as education is concerned. Education doesn't seem a priority. I don't care how often we go to schools and tell youngsters we cannot find them jobs unless they get the high school diploma. For some reason, it doesn't sink in. There also seems to be a family life, a deterioration in the family life. It seems to be that parents are not overly concerned. They may be concerned, but they're not really have a great amount of concern that their youngsters respect others and respect property of others. And you have a large amount of crime rate in Louisville, Kentucky, and I contribute that to be a part of it. if I may back up, when we look at dropouts in the city of Louisville, in the Louisville school system, there are over 2,000 dropouts a year. When I was coming up, that number wasn't even close to that. The youngster who started, it was a dishonor to drop out of school without getting your diploma. Today, it was a dishonor to be caught in a crime. Today, it seems as though our society applauds an individual that drops out of school. Our society applauds an individual that has a record. And we're seeing, number one, that there seems to be a deterioration in the family life and also in the aspiration of young people obtaining their high school diploma. In the employment arena, there seems to be a move afoot for blacks to be put in positions that traditionally blacks were not in, such as in the engineering arena, but it appears to be only on the window dressing farm. And other several companies I could name and say that, oh, they're doing an outstanding job. But the majority of companies that I deal with in the city of Louisville, I don't see a great amount of affirmative action.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Is the Urban League or any groups trying to perhaps combat this new attitude you're speaking about of the youngsters?
Every day. I just recently received a $68,000 funding for an ESA proposal that deals with student suspension and student dropouts. And we're going to try to change these students' negative attitudes into some positive ones in the academic arena and in the council. And we want to counsel them to get them back on the right track and in the right frame of mind. We tutor youngsters every Saturday. We tutor approximately 60 youngsters from grades 2 to grades 11. And I do this on my own time on Saturdays with the black and white youngsters at 28th and Virginia. We are finding out that teachers don't have the time, don't take out the time to work with youngsters on the one-to-one ratio. Sometimes it's understandable because they have so many children in the classroom. But we're seeing a basic lack of concern on the part of some teachers in trying to get this kid out of school. There has to be some way, children are evaluated on how well they do in school, but our system needs to come up with some type of evaluation on how well a teacher teaches that particular child. And unfortunately, that's not being done.
Heather, along the teachers, this may not be a fair question to ask you. There have been some people indicate that some of the less qualified teachers or less motivated teachers would often be shifted around and placed in the West End schools where they would just fill out their tenure and go away. Have you run into any
of that? I've heard of that. I've heard of that type of thing. And I've heard the same type of information passed along the police line. Some of the less qualified police or police who have done something wrong receive disciplinary action by being placed in the West End area, teachers being placed in the West End area. My mother's taught school for 30 years. And this to give you some type of idea of what's going on in the school system. She and another teacher have, there were three teachers. They have 90 years of teaching experience between them. They wanted to continue to teach in the West End schools when school desegregation came about. They had to go, I would say they have to drive approximately almost 40 miles a day to get to the school that they're going to teach at, the round trip. They found out that there were a lot of younger teachers who had less tenure than they did, could teach in a school in the West End, even though they didn't even put in for that school. In answer to your question, I'm saying that there's a move afoot, and it seems to be the move afoot to get some of the more qualified teachers out of the school system, to discourage them by having them to travel as much as they're traveling every day to teach at a school. We're seeing this. We have teachers that complain about this. I wouldn't put it past the officials that are over the school system to put younger, inexperienced teachers in West End schools. I've seen everything else done, so I wouldn't put it past them. I wouldn't write it off.
Have on all these things that we've been talking about, and especially in regards to education, job opportunities, and busing that we see today, how serious do you believe that is the white backlash problem in Louisville?
Yeah, I think it's very serious. I think it's very, very serious. I think in the 50s and the 60s, I thought Louisville was a very progressive city, despite the problems we had to have in getting some open housing and accommodation laws passed. But in the 70s, I believe the real Louisville, Kentucky, stood out as far as its racial attitudes and so forth. I didn't really actually realize that there was so much hostility between the races of people in this community. I didn't realize there was so much...
And you're talking about community now. I don't know if it'd be good to define this. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the city of Louisville or Jefferson County?
I'm talking about the city of Louisville and Jefferson County. Combined. I didn't know that there was a feeling of do-nothism in the part of political officials as far as working in a constructive manner with all peoples in this community. Black people have borne a large amount of frustration through the whole school desegregation process and really have borne a lot of unfair criticism, a lot of unfair amount of distrust. See, as a black person, my mother and father, my grandmother and grandfather, they were bused to schools. They were bused to schools when the school bus wasn't even yellow. Yeah, you know, the school bus was red, and they had to, oftentimes they were bused by the white school, which was right in the same neighborhood. And so busing really isn't anything new, but the attitudes that our city officials and leading governmental officials took in this effort, it just showed a complete disregard for a struggling people in this community. There was little, if any, regard for black people in this community, as far as safety for the children, as far as obeying the law of the land. We may not like the law of the land. For years, black folks have not liked the law of the land, but we have obeyed the law of the land. But you found ranking governmental officials, ranking political officials refusing to obey the law of the land. And it really brought out a great amount of concern on the part of blacks. I've even run into some formerly passive blacks, very, very passive, who are very hostile now because of the existing attitudes and do-nothism on the part of local officials to assist in a problem area.
Are you speaking in relation to busing now?
Right, in the area of school segregation. I'm speaking in that area right now.
Mm-hmm. And local officials include school?
Yeah, school administrators. I've been out to the county board many, many times, voicing some concerns on the safety of our children, voicing concerns on school principals and school administrators using racial slurs and addressing students. And to this day, the Urban League hasn't received any response. We are seeing that it's a great concern. Louisville is not the city that I thought it was. In the 50s and the 60s, I thought Louisville was a beautiful place to live. But I have a different attitude and mind frame of Louisville, Kentucky right now.
Do you have any hope that your efforts here in the Urban League may bring about a change in the attitude you're speaking of?
Well, we do hope so. The Urban League and the school desegregation crisis, because we are a United Way agency, we have to walk a tightrope in dealing with this particular issue. I go to the schools practically every week, and because I'm called out by a parent to look into some problem or some principal calls me out and wants me to talk to his class or to some students that are disrupted. I do hope that our efforts at the Urban League will assist, and by getting these funds from the ESSA project, $68,000 to address the problems of student dropout and student suspension, I feel that we can indirectly have some effect on this school system as far as the attitudes of young blacks and young white students towards the administrators at the school. Now, somebody else, I don't know who, needs to be dealing with the attitudes of administrators. If we can deal with the attitudes of students, then somebody ought to deal with that. Maybe the University of Louisville could do that.
Do you think that in the paper recently they were talking about the timeout rooms as an alternative to suspensions, and you indicated that one of the most important things would be to get kids to stay in school and
finish, and
change their attitude. Do you, I know this is a relatively new thing in Louisville, do you think that may hold some promise?
Well, I see you've been studying on this school system. I see that time, I've seen timeout rooms where they're not very constructive. In fact, many youngsters refer to, black youngsters refer to the timeout room as Siberia. A timeout room, if it's used in the way of addressing a kid's, a youngster's academic problem, if that youngster's taken out of his classroom and he's not keeping up with that class, if that person who's over that timeout room is not getting the academic needs and the academic curriculum of that youngster for that particular day, then I think the timeout room is a waste of time. If a youngster is going to sit in a timeout room and just play cards and just sit around some, play records, then that's a waste of time. The kid should be expelled or sent home. Just send him on out of school. But if a timeout room is used to work on the academic problems and work on some attitudinal problems of that youngster, to change that negative attitude into a positive attitude, then I think the timeout rooms are very, very positive. I even like the idea of the traditional schools where you have discipline in the classroom, because you cannot, I'm not a school teacher, I'm certified to teach school, but you cannot teach a class if there's no discipline in that classroom. And there are teachers in the school system. I visited 30 schools last month, and there are teachers in the school system who do not have discipline in their classroom, and so consequently they cannot deal with any academic subjects in their classroom. They are battling for survival in the classroom themselves. And I'm seeing that students don't respect teachers like they used to. And all of this may come from the combination of things that I mentioned.
Yeah.
The home environment, the teacher who may not be qualified to teach school. You just can't thrust a teacher out of college into an urban setting. At one time, you used to do that. But I think that teachers need, the colleges need to teach these teachers who are going out for their practice teaching how to deal in the urban setting, because they're going to deal with a lot of different attitudes and a lot of different problems.
Mm-hmm. I would just like to ask you now if you had any other general comments you'd like to make concerning the economic aspects of the Negro in Louisville's history.
Well, I think basically I have exhausted all of my efforts through this interview. I hope that what has been said will be helpful. Forgive me if I seem fatigued. I usually don't talk this long.
I kept you on for quite a bit.
But I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to share some things with you. And if any time I can be of any assistance to you, I'd be more than happy to.
Thank you very much,
okay.
Sir. I believe that concludes our interview.
All right.